I'm Terry Cooper. I chair the Senior Statesman's Program Committee. I'd like to thank you very much for coming. And as always, thank you very much to the Senior Center for hosting this program and the programs we've had for many, many years now. I know we would all very much like to see Denver Riggleman walk through those doors back there. I have no idea whether he will or not. I can tell you that I have personally made every effort I could to get him here. I personally visited his campaign headquarters 3 times. I explained that even though his campaign had declined, we were keeping the invitation open. And if he could come even at the last minute with no advance notice, we would have a seat for him and a name tag for him. So I know we would very much like to have him here, and who knows. Let me now proceed to introduce our moderator, Preston Bryant. Preston is a senior vice president with McGuire Woods Consulting, who specializes in energy, environmental, infrastructure, and economic development matters. He served 5 terms as a Republican member of the House of Delegates representing the city of Lynchburg and its bedroom community in Amherst County, Madison Heights. Preston then accepted Governor Kaine's invitation to become the Commonwealth Secretary of Natural Resources. And later he accepted President Obama's invitation to chair the National Capital Planning Commission, the central planning agency for all federal lands and buildings in the DC metro area. I've already asked and he can do nothing about Redskin tickets. Please join me in welcoming Preston Bryant, who will take over the program at this point.
Hello and welcome. What a crowd. This is quite a crowd. Just a little bit more about me. As Terry said, I was served as a Republican in the House of Delegates, and I've served as in a Democratic governor's administration. So I am just confused enough to be a good moderator for today. I grew up in Lynchburg, not too far down the road. My parents were born in Amherst County, so I know the Piedmont. And my wife Liz and I just moved to Richmond just about a dozen years ago. So I'm from around here and very much miss living in the Piedmont. So with Mr. Riggleman, who we regret is not here, we're going to try to be much more conversational. It's less a debate kind of format now, but let's do Phil Donahue style kind of engagement. We still remember who Phil Donahue is. It's been a while. I did not say Jerry Springer. We're not going to. Ms. Coburn will give her 5 minutes for an opening statement. During this time, we're going to be accepting written questions, only written, no raising hands and no shouting out, but just written questions. And we will do our best to get all of your written questions. If a question comes from you and I think it deserves a little bit of follow-up, I may gently ask a follow-up question. In between written questions, I have a number of questions myself I may ask. And just to let you know, we've got questions on the economy and foreign policy, questions about the district, immigration, education, Social Security, all of the kinds of matters and big issues that the next congressperson from the 5th District would have to engage in some fashion. So After a five-minute opening statement, we will begin the questions. And if you could, Ms. Coburn, try to answer the questions in about 3 minutes. You know, we're not going to be too rigid on the time, but we want to try to get as many questions as we can. So, and then we'll, when we're wrapping up, we'll have about a 2 or 3 minute just closing statement.
Okay.
Is that good?
That's good.
Okay, good. So the floor is yours for 5 minutes. Tell us about
yourself.
Who's
giving me time?
While you're running.
Time. Okay, great. Good afternoon. This is a great crowd. I'm very happy to be at the Senior Center. I am particularly glad to be at the Senior Center because senior issues or important things for older Americans are very important to me. And I think that there are some things that are right now in jeopardy, in danger, under assault. We have things going on with Medicare and Social Security that I think is of great concern. But let me start from the beginning for those of you who don't know me. I am a resident of Rappahannock County, and we in Rappahannock, where we have no stoplight and more cows than people, regard it as the most beautiful and really spectacular county in the district and the greatest place we could possibly be. We are fiercely attached to Rappahannock. Having said that, it's a very interesting place because Rappahannock is really between Charlottesville and Washington, D.C. We have lots of people who were in government there, as well as people who've been farming for five or six generations. So it is a lively, interesting, and wonderful mix of people, not to mention our innovative agriculture and very important vineyards, et cetera, and our great restaurants. So come to Rappahannock. But the reason why I am running, I've been in Rappahannock for nearly 20 years. It'll be my husband who is here too. Where is Andrew? There. My husband and I have been there for nearly 20 years on a really beautiful farm in the middle of Rappahannock. We migrated from Washington, both of us. My husband is still a practicing journalist, and I was a journalist for 35 years. So my background is an investigative journalist. I covered the world. I was a producer at 60 Minutes covering the world. I covered some of the most dangerous and difficult stories you can cover. And also I was a correspondent for Frontline, have written for many magazines, written books, etc. So foreign affairs was my patch, as well as Wall Street. But beyond that, the importance in terms of what is happening now in my life is that in order to do those stories, every single one of them had a piece on Capitol Hill. It was holding somebody's feet to the fire for what was going on outside of this country, but what was being done in your name. So I've had a great deal of experience on Capitol Hill as an outsider, which I was very comfortable in that position. I'm only jumping over the wall to be an insider because Donald Trump became president. I'm one of those women, and we are a huge wave who have responded to the Trump presidency by going into politics. As you'll notice, there are six women Democratic nominees for Congress in Virginia alone. And this is a really magnificent group of people who have all really excelled in their professions outside of government. And any one of those who get elected and go to Capitol Hill will make a great difference. They will be great negotiators. They'll be great leaders. But I am doing this because I reacted very strongly to Donald Trump. I reacted as a woman. I reacted as a woman who spent much of my adult career really fighting for issues like equal pay, being able to do the difficult jobs, being able to be, in my case, on the front lines. That was something. That was a boys' club, and breaking into that was not easy. And it was, for me, very, very important. So to come around at this point, to have Donald Trump, who offended me as a woman, but also more important, or equally important, offended me as a journalist, as a former journalist, because there have been sustained attacks on journalists as the enemy of the people. This, for me, is beyond the pale. We need journalism, no matter what kind of journalism. We need it in order to protect our democracy. There are a lot of places... There are a lot of places where that does not happen, and they really suffer for it. I can name you 30 countries where the journalism is, it's the rubber stamp, the government rubber stamp. This is what we don't need. And I would say beyond that, that what I see, given the experience that I have, is that our country is in serious crisis. It is in crisis. And enough people, an end? Okay, yeah. I'll leave you with the crisis. I think many people in this room understand what I'm saying.
So let me just follow up on that briefly. Your focus was very much on the current president. What about the 5th District? What about the benefits and the advocacy of the 5th District and not just taking on the White House? Tell us about the 5th District and why you're running.
3 minutes?
Yeah, please.
Okay. As I mentioned, I feel very passionately about the 5th District. When I started running, I had another opponent. It was Tom Garrett. And Tom Garrett, for me, is absolutely a mini Trump. So what I was seeing was an extension of Trump in the 5th District. Tom Garrett immediately voted, as soon as he came in, he voted to take health care away from 23 million people. He voted against every possible iteration of environmental policy. He's voted to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency. He voted for a tax bill which adds $1.9 trillion to the deficit. So he was my opponent. Then, once I won the caucus convention, he was no longer my opponent. But I am now up against someone who, again, I believe will not serve the 5th District well. There are many issues. As you know, I've put 65,000 miles on the car going around 21 counties for over a year. Actually, it's 15 months now. Seeing exactly what we need in this district and name an issue.
But let me ask a little bit politically about the 5th District. Over the years, it's had both Republican and Democratic members of Congress. If we go back to Dan Daniel from Danville many years ago, and L.F. Payne from Nelson County was a Democrat, then your very own Tom Perriello here. But it's also, if you look at the district, it's been trending red-ish in recent years. As you've traveled about the district in 65,000 miles, what are you seeing politically out there that you think this is the year that a Democrat can win a red-ish 5th district? What are you hearing from the road and from the farms and from the manufacturers and the retail?
Okay, I think it's absolutely possible for a Democrat to win this year. And this is why. There are a lot of people. There really is a blue wave going on, and it's going on in the 5th. And I think it's a combination of things. Women are riled up, and this is very, very important. I'd say 80% of the activism among Democrats is women, and it's not just Charlottesville and Albemarle. It is everywhere. The other night I was in Lunenburg, and you see it there as much as you do here. Last night I was in Danville, likewise. So I'd say we have a really even chance. It is regarded as a red district, but inside every red county, and I give my own county as an example, Rappahannock, we have Democrats who are suddenly finding each other. There are people in this room who know this phenomenon where you have no idea there's another Democrat in the county, and suddenly you realize that it's not just a dozen, but maybe there are 100, 200, 300. That's what's happening this year. We have all kinds of grassroots activity. We have Indivisibles. We have Resisters. We have the Lefty Lunch Ladies. We have a lot of people who are coming out, and that is what characterizes this year, and it is building on what happened with the elections for House of Delegates last year.
We have the first two questions, and one is a good follow-up to this. It's a political kind of question, in a 5th District demographic kind of question. It says, I'll note first that previously Jane Dittmar, who was from around here, lost to Tom Garrett by 58-41. And so this question is, what are you doing differently from Jane Dittmar 2 years ago to win this crucial election?
First of all, Jane, who many of you probably know, is a wonderful woman and a very generous mentor. She was very generous to all the Democratic candidates. So I learned a lot from Jane. She feels that she really laid the groundwork for the possibility of winning this year, and I would say that is 100% correct. She ran a great campaign. This is a different year. We've had Garrett in office, and my people are fed up. We have had Trump in office, and there's a whole record there now to fight against, and Jane was not in that position. It's a very different time.
A second question, and this will be the first one getting into issues. Do you endorse the concept of Medicare for all, and what are your reasons for or against?
I do endorse Medicare for all. And the reason I do is, first of all, getting it done is a tall order, but believe me, it's becoming more and more popular on Capitol Hill. A lot of people are signing on to these bills. There's a very good bill in the House, 676, and you have, I think, 121 people who've already signed on to it. The bills include a period when Medicare would go onto the exchange as an option. The reason why this would be very attractive for people is because you could buy into it, because the overhead is so much cheaper than the regular private insurance companies. I mean, it's 18-19% versus 3%. So Medicare will be very attractive. A lot of people will be drawn to it, and that will pull in a large group of people, hopefully from the, and particularly ages of 50 to 65. So that will start happening after a period. Because this is a serious option now, moving to Medicare for all, there are some excellent studies, thousands of pages long, of how we're going to achieve this. But basically what you have to realize is that we have the most dysfunctional healthcare system in the world. We are, WHO did a study of, which I find interesting, fairness in healthcare. 191 countries. We came in 54th behind Bangladesh and the Maldives. So we have a lot of work to do. It is, and even in Charlottesville itself, where you have excellent health care, in the shadow of those buildings at the great hospitals here, you have African American women who are 10 times more likely to die in childbirth than their white counterparts. These are things that, when you look at something like this, they can and will be addressed. I see many solutions beyond the big picture of Medicare for All, which will cuts $400 billion off of administrative costs, let alone how about, and I would like to lead the way on this on the Hill, given my 60 Minutes background, how about really holding Big Pharma's feet to the fire? How about being able to negotiate drug prices? I am continually in this district running into people who cannot afford their drugs and who are parceling out their pills. They're breaking them in half. I was in Bedford the other day with a whole group of people who, with cancer, with migraine headaches, severe migraine headaches, and they are not taking their medication. We need to negotiate. I have time.
So let me ask a couple of follow-up questions on health care, and these are my own questions. And I had one also on Medicare for All. It won't be cheap. How much will it cost, and how would it be paid for? What's the dollar figure out there?
Okay, first of all, you have to, before you get into cost, think about this. How much are you paying for your health care? I mean, some people here are already on Medicare. They've got good health care, but some people aren't. I will give you the example of a family in four in Charlottesville on the individual market. They can pay $36,000 a year for health care because we have one provider, it's a monopoly. Because Trump pulled out the legs from under the insurance companies who are no longer subsidized, they fled $36,000 a year with a $12,000 deductible. 36 plus 12 is $48,000 a year. You could have Medicare for All for the same family paying extra taxes, not paying that amount, but not paying $48,000, but paying $800 in taxes versus $48,000 to a private insurance company. That sounds like a good deal. So it is a matter of really seriously restructuring this. Plus, remember, we already pay $3.5 trillion a year in healthcare costs. And this is not just Medicaid, Medicare, et cetera, VA. This is when people are sick in the fifth, let's say in Cumberland County, they do not have a facility right nearby. And even if they're well, they don't have preventative care. So by the time they get to the emergency room, they have severe heart disease, they have diabetes. They have a whole range of severe issues, and the cost is astronomical if that's how you're getting your health care, and it's astronomical for us because we're paying for it. So we already have huge health care costs, and we're also paying, there are lots of tax advantages that we're paying for companies because of the way it's structured now. So it will be expensive, but in the end, that family of four will not have to forego health care.
But let me ask again, when you net it out from the current system versus a new Medicare for All system, all said and done, and it's netted out at the end of the day, what do the studies show? I don't know. What do the studies show in terms of
I'm seeing so many different figures.
What does it cost?
They all cost trillions of dollars.
Yes.
But I'm seeing so many different figures, yes. I would hesitate to give you that. But I will say that when when we hear, oh, it's going to cost so much, let me just extend the context of this. I hear it's going to cost so much. What are our priorities? If healthcare is a priority, then perhaps we wouldn't spend quite so much on endless wars that we are not winning. We are spending many trillions of dollars. There's a Brown study that shows, plus we have serious obligations to veterans who've come, tens of thousands of people who came out of those wars wounded, who we have to look after. That's first priority. And those costs are roughly right now about $4.7 trillion, given, including those costs. We are not winning these wars. Can we perhaps address the fact that one of the biggest problems with our deficit is tax cuts started in the Bush administration in 2003? What was 2003? We went into Iraq. So we went into a war cutting taxes. And I saw a very interesting study by Janet Yellen and many of her peers who said this is the big problem, tax cuts plus unfunded, endless wars. Let's address that. Then let's shovel some of those trillions over into healthcare.
All right, so let me
And one last thing. This is the most, we spend more, and I think people know this, we spend more on healthcare on individual Americans than any other country in the world. Double at least. In the case of Japan, it's three times.
So let's localize it a little bit in terms of cost or impact. It's true that we have among the most complex healthcare financing structures you could possibly imagine in any country anywhere in the world. And across the 5th District, you have a variety of hospitals. You have a large research and teaching hospital at the University of Virginia. You have not-for-profit hospitals like Sentara's Martha Jefferson, and you have for-profit hospitals like SOVA, what used to be the Danville Regional Medical Center. You may not know this, and I don't know this, but I'm just thinking about, in my private business, I work a little bit with hospitals that come in contact with hospitals and the way they're funded, and it's just very complex. But I wonder if there is such a change from the current system to a Medicare for All system, how would we transition it so that the variety of hospitals that we have, the large teaching research hospitals, the not-for-profit, the profits, how would they be impacted or how would they be not hurt in such a transition from the current healthcare administration to Medicare for All? Wax on eloquently from that inarticulate question.
When you talk to, it's a really important question, and when you talk to people around the district, hospitals and doctors, they say, yeah, we would love to streamline the system. It would make our lives so much easier. So there are many doctors and hospitals who support this transition. And there are so many smart people in Charlottesville who are in this world who are happy to advise on this and how to do it so that people don't get hurt and hospitals don't get penalized. In fact, what we've seen recently with Medicaid expansion has been excellent for hospitals who are going broke in this district.
Yeah.
So thank goodness we have Medicaid expansion finally. But so I would say on balance, really, it is so complicated and so Byzantine for the hospitals to have to deal with these systems as they are. They would welcome something a little more streamlined. But, you know, how this will work, this is going to take years to figure out. But what's great is that in Washington now there's the will. Lots of presidential hopefuls are signing up for this and want to get it done. And I think that the first step when you put Medicare on the exchange, that's going to be so popular that it's really people will start, their eyes will open. And that's something, that part of it is something that that Tim Kaine is pushing too.
So a lot. I have one more healthcare question. So related, it will take years, and I presume you support the Affordable Care Act now, Obamacare. But in even Obamacare's great supporters think that it needs to be improved. It's got some defects, but it can be improved. So what in the short term, relatively speaking, how can we improve Obamacare as we work toward and then possibly transition to a Medicare for All?
Well, what's happened to Obamacare? Obamacare had flaws, which everyone knew when they went into it. But there are even more flaws now, because now the subsidies have been removed from insurance companies. The whole structure has been undermined, and also they've taken away the individual mandate. The Trump administration has done that, which means the pool of healthy people who can pay for the help pay for the less healthy people has been undermined. Now we have a situation where the Trump administration is saying that it is unconstitutional to guarantee health care to people with pre-existing conditions. Now, I don't know about you. Let me see. Can someone put their hand up who does not have a pre-existing condition? Maybe some of the really young people in back. But going around the 5th District, I rarely see a hand up. So to take that away is, in my view, criminal. I know many people with pre-existing conditions.
So transitioning a little bit away from healthcare, but not too far afield, there's a question, what would you do to deal with the issue of guns and the senseless shootings?
Okay.
And where are you on gun control while we're at it?
3 minutes?
Sure.
Okay. This issue is, it's an interesting one. I'm an odd candidate this way. I grew up in a house of hunters. Both my parents were hunted many things, birds as well as other things. So the issue in my house, there was always a gun. Actually, there were always probably three or four. But they were for hunting, and the issue was gun safety. We were all trained in that. So as a teenager, I learned to hunt. I was out in the duck blind with my dad and my mother, but often with my father. So I had that experience. I understand that culture. And we do, you know, there are a group of people who hunt on my farm. So we've got hunters for Leslie. But on the other hand, as an adult, I covered six wars. So I've seen almost every conventional weapon there is fired, some of them really far too close to me. I really make a distinction between a weapon of war and something we use for hunting. So I am a full supporter of hunters and hunting, and I see it as a whole hunting culture, which I think is very strong and very, very important in Virginia. But weapons of war, I really don't see the point. I don't see the point of untrained people having access to weapons of war. So I support the assault weapons ban of 2018. And remember, we had one between 1994 and 2004. We had one, and it really made a big difference. But also, there are a whole range of things I support the majority of gun owners, and many Democrats are gun owners, support. And that is, of course, the loopholes, the gun show loopholes. Also important for me is if you are guilty of domestic violence, you should not carry a weapon. And we know that that affects over 50% of these massacre incidents, including the terrible Texas shooting. And we don't need bump stocks. You know, these are things that only the NRA is fighting this stuff. Most gun owners agree and approve. So we need to get away from the notion that somebody's going to take people's guns away. In fact, there is nothing on the table that will take people's guns away. The assault weapons ban really affects going forward. So, and I think if the NRA could be a useful organization, needless to say, I will not take their money. If they could be useful, if they provided training. Now, that was the original notion, and my time is up.
Well, on that, kids in the 5th District and all across rural Virginia grow up hunting and with guns. There's no right or wrong answer to this. At what age should kids perhaps be trained and to use guns and safely for sporting and hunting and such?
Well, I learned as a teenager.
Yeah.
There was a Sacha Baron Cohen spoof recently, where they had kindergartens and some luminaries in Virginia and other politicians like Trent Lott all agreed that we could train kindergartners in shooting. I am not for that. I think being, you know, it's a good idea being a teen, I'd say, to really, you know, fully grasp the hunting ethic and rules and how to behave and things that Dick Cheney never learned.
Let's switch to education, and we have a question on education, and it's a good one. It's a philosophical one. That's the wrong question. Sorry. Ah, here it is. What is your opinion on the federal role on the federal role in K-12 education?
Well, the federal government has a huge role in education, and believe me, around this district, education is it bumps up against healthcare as a top issue, particularly for women, because they are thinking about public schools, and public schools are being terribly squeezed. First of all, we don't pay our teachers enough. Let me just say that from the outset. Again, this is a matter of priorities. For me, the role of a teacher could not be more important in a democracy. Children need to learn. And I think that there is a whole range of things, in fact, that are on the table in the House of Representatives that many Democrats support, and all I have to do is add my name to increase education funding for counselors, for after-school programs. There's a whole range of things that if we don't get them here in the 5th District, we have a serious problem. And it bleeds over, by the way, into the Trump administration is trying to cut back on SNAP. And the problem with nutrition and learning, I was in Campbell County the other day with a dairy farmer, 74-year-old dairy farmer, who said, if we do not give the kids these school lunches. They are hungry at home. Over 50% of the kids in Campbell County are hungry at home if they don't get those school lunches. So he said, if they don't get that food, they cannot learn. And if they cannot learn, there's no place for them in an American dream. That means leaving behind all the kids in Campbell County. And believe me, in Cumberland and a lot of other places, it's just as bad. So it's not just an issue of funding for the schools. I really support, on the whole SOL issue, I really support increased innovation. I want to allow teachers to teach. And so I will fight for that. So it's a matter of funding. I was very happy to see that Betsy DeVos did not get her way. She wanted to massacre funding for public schools, and in fact, she was. They fought her on that, both Democrats and Republicans on the Hill.
Education is important, and not every kid goes to college. Fifth District has some great universities, from Averett University in Danville to Piedmont Virginia Community College and Danville Community College, and of course our own University of Virginia. But the 5th District is largely rural and historically has had a great manufacturing base, so workforce development is very important. Governor Northam has taken on workforce development perhaps as vigorously as most previous governors. He's appointed to, at the cabinet level, a workforce advisor. Workforce is centrally important in the jurisdiction of community colleges. Talk a little bit about what you're seeing as you travel across the 5th District and meeting with the Campbell County dairy farmers and visiting the manufacturers and what they're up against in terms of skilled labor, workforce. What are they seeing coming out of our public schools, how they're trained, how they're ready to go to work? What are you seeing out there?
Okay, we have... I have spent a lot of time going around looking at vocational training. Mm-hmm. We've got some fantastic vocational training. For example, Virginia Technical Institute in Alta Vista, a great program. Every single person who comes out of there as a highly skilled infrastructure professional, I'll call them. These are people who can build a bridge or build a skyscraper. They can repair America, and we need repair. Every single one of those people who come out of there get a job. There are more jobs in those areas for the welder, for the top plumber, for the electrician, for the people who can really do the job. There are many more jobs than there are people able to do it in the district. So we need to remember, when we think about we need jobs, we have jobs. We just need to make sure that the training people are getting fits the job, one. And there is a whole range of things. I've discovered that, for example, I am pro-union. I'm, in fact, a union member. So I went to see a bunch of the union training facilities in Maryland, the national training facilities. These are like universities. People really come out of those, very skilled. They pay, there's no student loans. They don't pay anything. They go in and they're already being paid as they go in working beside someone highly skilled. Those people then can do any work, and they get work, and they can move all over the country, and indeed internationally. They're very desirable. So those union people, I was at a meeting with the union people and people from the Department of Education in Virginia. High school students don't even know about those programs. There's a communication gap in Virginia. We need to educate our students who want those very highly skilled and really remunerative jobs that you can go with the union program. Or if you don't want to go there, you can go to VTI, which is not, that's run by businesses, though there are union people teaching there. So there are options, but also the difference between different community colleges in the Fifth is huge. Some have very good programs. Others have programs that you can go in and you really can't get a job when you get out. You need to be retrained. So we need to make sure that it's equalized so that the levels of all these schools rise. And we need to make use of one really important employment point here is there is a renaissance coming of renewable energy, and it's here. It's in Charlottesville, and there are things going on in every single county of the 5th District. We have a great center down in Rocky Mount in Franklin County for renewable energy. It's underutilized, so we need to make sure that we replicate that and we support it.
In your answer, you hit on something that's very important, still sticking to education, and that is student loans. Across the country, the total dollar of outstanding student debt is $1.5 trillion. In Virginia, the average student who has a debt is $30,000. So if you're at Averett University in Danville with 1,000 students, or the University of Virginia with 16,000 undergraduates, a huge portion of them are graduating with $30,000 worth of debt. What do we do?
Okay, first of all, I regard this as shameful, and I regard it's like we're eating our young. We have a whole generation that are going into debt peonage because of this problem, because they're learning. The Consumer Finance Protection Bureau asked students to let them know about the problems that they're having. They got 30,000 responses. And for example, there was one student, no longer a student, but he had amassed $150,000 in debt. 10 years later, there was another $60,000 on top because of the capitalized interest. We can deal with this. First of all, the prices are shocking. We need to support the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. They are the ones shining the light on this. We need to make sure that those offices at the Department of Education, which are stacked high with issues of students who have been defrauded by institutions, that those are addressed, because right now those desks are empty. The Department of Education is not fully staffed, and that is by design. So we need to make sure that the interest rates are brought down. This is not just a problem for students. This is a problem for their grandparents. Right now, bankruptcy among the grandparents has gone up three times since 1991, and in many cases, aside from ballooning healthcare costs, the problem is that they have co-signed student loans. So it's a huge problem for two generations.
So some states have gone to, or various variations of, free community college. New York, think, has done it under Governor Cuomo, but as we all know, ain't nothing free. Do you support, or at least conceptually, it's more of a state issue than a federal issue, but the concept of free community college, and if so, how would we pay for it? Does the federal government have a role in helping states underwrite community college?
My answer is yes. I think that 2 years of community college should be free, and I think it's the whole purpose of community college. Should be free. And when you say, well, how do we pay for that? Well, let me tell you, I'll give you a nice figure, which is the defense budget has gone up $82 billion this year. $82 billion can pay for the college education of every student in America with about $12 billion left over. It's a matter of priorities. Right now, we have on an Air Force transport plane, we have a toilet seat cover that costs $10,000. $10,000 pays for a lot of education. So I really think that you need to first of all establish the fact that education is a top priority and that community college has a huge role to play for those students who don't automatically want to go on to UVA, and that at that level, at the community college level, it is there that they can be, if they haven't been properly introduced to all the possibilities beyond, I do still believe people should be studying government and history and English, but at the same time that they can be exposed to all sorts of wonderful trades that they might want to get into, and then channeled into, shown all of the opportunities available in the 5th, and there are many.
So I've got one more education question, and it's a wah-hoo-wah question. University of Virginia is a great research institution. They get about $400 million in federal research dollars. Three-fourths of that, roughly $300 million of the $400 million, is federal. How are you going to fight for good old UVA and Wahoo-Wah and help them achieve their goal of even more research dollars from NSF and NIH and others?
This is the reason why we do need to support this. UVA is doing great things for not only Charlottesville, but for the whole Fifth. So let's say there's a brilliant idea at UVA. That moves over to APEX, renewable energy, for example. I don't know if any of you know APEX. Yep. In the past 8 years, they've grown so that they have 200 employees in the district. They also have wind and solar operations all over the country, including a solar field at Fort Hood, Texas, for the Pentagon, which is saving the Pentagon a lot of money. So a company like APEX exists thanks to UVA, and there are a number. That's just one example. But APEX is also operating a solar field, just starting, but they will be doing it near Alta Vista, where I mentioned Virginia Technical Institute. They now have a position at VTI, which is a solar technician position. In other words, thanks to UVA, we have APEX. Thanks to APEX, we're doing something great in Campbell County. And thanks to that, we are also going to be training 5th District people in renewable energy. This is all from UVA, and I see it all the time.
So I've got a couple of questions here from the audience that are related. One is, can't we all get along? What's happening in our country? If we look out socially or sociologically, culturally, we see that there's a degradation of respect for our traditional institutions, whether it's the presidency or Congress or the media, or even if you measure it as to how fewer people go to church and synagogue regularly as opposed to 10 or 40 years ago, there's a change. Wax on philosophically about what's going on in the country out there in terms of losing respect for each other and our institutions, and then I've got a couple other follow-up related questions.
Well, I think that it's very distressing what's happening in our country along those lines. But I do think that you see it, I mean, historically, if you look, you can look at Northern Ireland, look at Catholics and Protestants, how divided they were until the EU money started pouring into Northern Ireland, which was a very unifying factor. Or you can look at societies in the Middle East where you have now terrible splits between Sunni and Shia that weren't there, that they were aggravated, that they were forced by different groups. You saw that in Iraq. I mean, it's what propelled Iraq into a really terrible civil war. Here in this country, I think there is increased polarization, and I think that the notion of reaching across the aisle is becoming more difficult. However, what happened in the House of Delegates last year is instrumental. The House of Delegates now has many more Democrats after the election last November. What that means is it's a more equal pool so that things can happen and people are desiring to reach across the aisle when it's a more equal balance. If we do that on Capitol Hill, if we do that in the House of Representatives, if we have more Democrats so that they're not just an oppressed minority, if we have more Democrats, then we will see more partnerships between the Democrats and the Republicans. It is inevitable. And I'm cheered. Yesterday I was with a group of people who care a great deal about climate change issues, for example. They're bipartisan. And they have organized a group, a climate caucus, where every Democrat has a Republican partner because they agree on the issues of, carbon fees. They agree on this. You're talking about 86 people there or more. They're working together. It is possible. I do think that on Capitol Hill, which is endlessly called a swamp and whatnot, I think you have an imbalance of power, and you need to correct that. I think we need the Democrats to take the House or come close to it, and then you'll see a more civilized environment.
Well, I've got a little bit of experience of that. When I served in the House of Delegates, the Republicans were in the minority. And the closer we, it's a 100-member House, and the closer we got to parity, to 50-50, when it was 47 Republicans and 53 Democrats, for example, we were all at each other's throats because the stakes were so high. There was a time when we actually got to be 50-50, and we got along like brothers and sisters.
There's the answer.
Mostly because we were afraid to kill each other's bills because you would get your own bills killed. And so we actually worked together quite closely. So this is another question from the audience, and you sort of answered it, but I want to follow up just a little bit. Beyond the answer of just elect more Democrats and we'll all get along better, which is debatable, the question is, and you were sort of getting at it, but how would you work to restore the loss of comity in Washington? So beyond just electing you and your colleagues, how would you restore the loss of comity?
I think that I think there's some endemic problems in Washington. One is I'm not taking any corporate PAC money. I think it would be good if other people did the same. I think that I think we would increase comity if we had a situation where we had members who were responsive to their constituents rather than to large corporations. And I think that I look at the situation in Washington right now. I see it as a disaster, actually. But this is, you and I may have very different views on this, but I think that what's going on in the White House is I don't think we have leadership. I really don't think we have leadership. I just read a book recently by a group of psychiatrists who analyzed our president. And I also think that there is a tendency in the House and the Senate, there is this kind of lockstep behavior, which I think is unfortunate, and I think I don't think we want an autocrat, and I don't think we want that kind of rubber stamp solution for Capitol Hill.
So the another question that's right on point as a follow-up from the audience is, so what are the issues that you can see working together with Republicans? Name a few.
There are lots of issues that we can work together on. For example, given the events on August 12th last year, where we saw a horrible divide here in Charlottesville, we got invaded, and there was terrible trauma, and many groups were deeply affected by this. What can a congressperson do to build something positive out of that? All right, let's attack. First of all, let's make it clear that we recognize there is racism and there is anti-Semitism, and we must do everything we can to stop it. And but what can we do? I believe that we need to attack institutional racism, for example, and that means criminal justice reform, school-to-prison pipeline. There are many Republicans who agree on the issue of criminal justice reform. Mm-hmm. And I can see a number of people who I could work with on that. And I think that in many other, when you talk about waste, fraud, and abuse in government, and particularly with those agencies which don't have a lot of oversight, I think it's very easy to find partners on the Republican side. You know, this is not a difficult thing. It's only hard when, if you have a situation where the parties are forced to act in lockstep, then it's harder to make those arrangements and come to agreements. So I think a little more free thinking would be good. But I think that I think there are obstructionists on the Hill. I think that, for example, my missing opponent would like to join the Freedom Caucus. I think the Freedom Caucus has been a very bad influence on Capitol Hill in terms of people working together.
So, or another question from the audience that is a Capitol Hill politics question. Where do you stand on Nancy Pelosi continuing in a position of leadership?
Okay.
Doesn't say which position, but it
all right, well, that's the Republicans' favorite question. In fact, in the fundraising letter for my elusive opponent, it says that I was handpicked by Nancy Pelosi. I'm afraid it's not true. My position is very simple. Who's going to do the most for the 5th District? My job is to represent the 5th. So any leader who says, you know, I'm going to help you out with X, Y, and Z in the 5th, I'm going to vote for them, because that's what everyone in this room would like. I will say about Nancy Pelosi that she is a powerful woman. She's a great fundraiser. She's an important negotiator. And I think she's been a target for a lot of things. That being said, I do think that the issue of leadership comes down to really the interest of the 5th.
But whether it's Nancy Pelosi or a Republican leader, they pretty much demand lockstep. You talked about more free thinking and not walking in lockstep. That's likely easier said than done. Talk a little more about that.
That's something I'll have to experience.
Yeah.
But I do see among the Democratic members, I have a lot of friends who are going to be great mentors, and including a lot of the Virginia delegation is absolutely great. Don Beyer, for example, Bobby Scott, Jerry Connolly. These people are leaders, and they really are looking for, they just need more people to come in and help them. So I think that there are, you know, it isn't all lockstep. We have, among Democrats, as among Republicans, we've got a big range of Democrats up there. I mean, they're from progressives to blue dogs. It's a huge range. And somehow people manage to work together. I think I will find that way.
We've got about 30 minutes left, and I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about foreign policy, which I know is something of your wheelhouse. In the 1990s, you wrote two books, one on the U.S.-Israeli relationship and one on Russian nuclear security. What was going on in your life at the time, and why did you write these books? You've written other books as well, but what was the thesis of each of these books, and tell us about them.
The book on Israel was about U.S.-Israeli relations, but particularly about military and intelligence relations. And I had at that point spent, I co-wrote that with my husband. We'd both spent a lot of time in the Middle East. I've covered almost every country in the Middle East, except Oman, because nothing ever happens there. But it was a hard-hitting book on looking at the relationship. It was a national bestseller and was even serialized in the Israeli papers. I've been criticized by the Republicans. As soon as I won the caucus convention, the Republicans came out and shouted, because she wrote this book, she's an anti-Semite. Well, I mean, that's ridiculous. Journalism is not anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is what we saw on August 12th in Charlottesville. Anti-Semitism is a synagogue being menaced by people carrying weapons saying Sig Heil. Anti-Semitism is people saying Jews will not replace us on the grounds of UVA. That is anti-Semitism, and it is appalling and disgusting. But writing about policy and writing tough journalism like that is, in my view, a good thing to do. And it is also the view of J Street, which is the biggest pro-Israel, pro-peace PAC in Washington. And they have endorsed my candidacy. And although when I get to Capitol Hill as a freshman, I will probably be in an obscure office and in an obscure committee, It is unlikely that I will be leading the charge on foreign affairs. However, I do feel with a group like J Street, what is great about them is they're smart, and they allow you to be pro-Israel, which I am totally. I understand the point, the historical reasons for the relationship between the two countries, and I applaud them. But it also allows you to make to a little wiggle room so that you can say, you know, I really think that Iran deal was a good deal, and I think it was good for the security of Israel, it was good for the security of the United States, and to run away from that is wrong, regardless. So I feel very comfortable with that. I mean, as a politician, my votes on the Hill will absolutely. I mean, if you go to the J Street site and you can see the way this group of people think, and I think it is very pro democracy, pro human rights, and pro Israel. So I'm happy there.
Before you go, on the Israeli-Palestinian situation, is a two-state solution possible?
Yes, it is possible. It is difficult, extremely difficult, and I hope I'm not roped into helping with that. But it is difficult, but it is possible. And it is possible because no matter how acrimonious things get, no matter how difficult things are, and they are very difficult in Gaza and the West Bank, there are people on both sides who can sit down. And I know this, the reason why I know this is possible and why the United States has a critical role here is because the model is Northern Ireland. My husband's Irish. I have witnessed a huge, and I covered Northern Ireland many years ago. So I've seen Catholics and Protestants who would just never speak to each other, who would kill each other's mothers, you know, in a heartbeat. However, once there was economic opportunity for everyone, and it really was the EU money washed over Northern Ireland, and suddenly you had people working together. The United States is a catalyst. We have two groups who cannot see eye to eye, and the United States has to be involved to bring this together and make a two-state solution possible. I really believe it is possible. It takes vision, and it takes intelligence, and it takes an understanding of history.
Russia,
okay. That book, the Russia book, which again, that was, I've co-written a couple of books with my husband, that was also co-written with him. That was about a big problem. Once the wall fell, institutions collapsed in Russia. It was an incredible place to work in as a journalist because you could go into the old Lubyanka. You could go in to talk to generals who had worked on top secret programs, and they would say, yeah, come on in, no problem. Coffee, you know, vodka, what can I give you? But those days are over. But at that time, a big problem was the loosening of all the restrictions and the potential for nuclear materials to escape Russia. It was on everybody's mind, and it was we did a very interesting investigation and found that indeed, I mean, we broke the story. General Lebed, who is no longer with us, a very important Russian general, who admitted that there were missing Russian nuclear suitcases, a story which we put into the book and also which I did for 60 Minutes as well. Those issues of missing nuclear materials are still alive and well, and many of the people in that field feel that that book and that work that we did was really important in furthering things. And we also, you know, initiated, we did the treatment and co-produced a movie called The Peacemaker. I don't know if any of you ever saw that, but it was about that issue of missing nuclear materials. Taking on those kinds of subjects, those are very difficult stories to do. I'll give you another example. Before 9/11, I was constantly in the office of 60 Minutes. I was always agitating. In fact, I agitated at ABC. I agitated everywhere to really take on what was going on after the World Trade Center bombing in 1993. Which many of you probably remember. Fortunately, it didn't bring down the buildings at that time. But I investigated it, and the investigation led me to Afghanistan, which had fallen apart at that point. The Russian war was over. All the Mujahideen groups we had supported were trying to destroy each other. They flattened Kabul. I was there in 1993 when that happened. But what I was looking for were, why did this happen in New York? And went back and found the whole story of the Arab Mujahideen, many of whom were still there. And this is the Osama bin Laden group, who initially had been sponsored covertly by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia to help in the Russian war. But they stayed, and they were angry. And they were a group that obviously got involved in very, very serious terrorism of all kinds. But investigating those kinds of stories, and like the Middle East story, the Russian story, these are not easy. They are very, very difficult. But revealing, once you understand, I'm on time, but once you understand that there is a cadre of people who are have a certain interest, we could easily foresee that something was going to happen on 9/11. I did a big story at 60 Minutes the year before warning about it.
So broadly speaking, what country or countries are America's biggest geopolitical or security foes?
Well,
I can think of a few.
Yeah, having been in so many wars, I'm not pro-war. I do not think that the solution in the next year is to go to war in Iran, for example, because that will be yet another endless war. It is not going to lead to any kind of solution, which is why we need to always go back to the diplomatic solution of something like the Iran deal. We have shifting foes. I really think that in all of our foreign policy decisions, we should think about, Trump calls it America first. I look at it very differently. You know, we have a very complex relationship with China. What's happening now with the tariffs? They've just added tariffs onto $16 billion worth of U.S. goods, which is doing serious damage to the Fifth District, these tariffs, to farmers. We need good relations with China. And indeed, we need good relations with Russia, but the relations that we need with Russia are not about the Russians giving loans to the President of the United States. Our foes are, they're shifting. It's, Pakistan, for example. Pakistan are the backers of the Taliban. Are they our foes? Well, they're also our partners in other aspects, like making sure that their nuclear weapons are secure. It's very complicated looking at our friends and foes, but in my case, I am a huge believer in diplomacy.
So on that, a question from the audience. What is your take on diplomacy with North Korea?
Well, it's been a very strange experience to watch. I certainly applaud diplomacy with North Korea. I think that in doing so, we should always take into consideration, foremost, what are the needs and the desires of the South Koreans? Because South Korea, any misstep and Seoul is obliterated. It's not far from the border. So I believe in listening to experts. I think that our president is not fond of doing that, which I think is unfortunate. I think we need to listen to people who are deeply involved in these things, and we need to respect those people, seasoned U.S. diplomats in Viz Korea who are in second and third channel discussions with the Koreans. We need to give them room to move, and we don't need someone in the White House who is going to make a decision on his own.
So President Trump and the administration says that North Korea must denuclearize. Today's newspaper, literally today's Richmond Times-Dispatch, has an article where John Bolton says, National Security Advisor Bolton says that Chairman Kim is doing nothing to speak of. He's not moving to denuclearize. As a matter of fact, just the opposite. He continues to be on an R&D kind of path. So looking forward, let's say President Trump or the next president, and North Korea is not going to go away, continues trying the diplomatic route. And against all failings, Chairman Kim is getting inches from developing a nuclear weapon, and we know where the facility is. Do you see any circumstance where you would support a military strike that's surgical to take out a nuclear? And I know that's a very complex question.
No, it isn't. It's actually, for me, a very simple question. First of all, these strikes are rarely surgical. Mm-hmm. And second, I mean, believe me, I've seen a lot of non-surgical strikes. But also, let's broaden this a little bit. North Korea is not the only country with nuclear weapons.
Right.
Let's look at Pakistan. They have a big arsenal. And it's very dangerous because the Pakistani military is totally infiltrated by people who really do not agree with the United States, who were very supportive of Osama bin Laden, which is why he was living in a military enclave. Therefore, we have one country that already has nuclear weapons. We have another that we're concerned that they may build nuclear weapons. I'd be more concerned about Pakistan at the moment, actually. And of course, we have concerns about Iran as well. But as I say, strikes aren't surgical. It's not going to stop. If they want to build nuclear weapons, they are going to do that. They have partnered partnered with Pakistan on building weapons. And we need to, the people, when you're dealing with something like this, it always comes down to diplomacy and nonproliferation. It's long talks into the night at 3 a.m. among people who really understand these weapons. It is not going to be solved with a surgical strike. I would really caution against that.
We've got about 15 minutes left before you get to close, so let's hit quickly on a couple of issues that are of interest. I know. Social Security. For as long as I can remember, Social Security has been in trouble, is the phrase. Not sustainable, looming insolvency. Today, more than 60 million Americans receive Social Security. And by 2037, I think that's the date, it's perhaps, looming toward insolvency. Of the so-called fixes that have been proposed, there are really three that you most commonly hear about: reducing benefits, raising taxes to fix it, or borrowing more money.
Well, first of all,
which of those do you support?
I do support. I can tell you right away. You put it as raising taxes. I say raise the cap. And I think what you will find is people want it to be solvent, and many people would not mind. I mean, I certainly wouldn't have minded when I was getting my paycheck if the cap had been raised a bit. Wouldn't have bothered me a bit, because it is really the potential for destroying Social Security, which is not an entitlement, by the way. We all pay into it our entire lives. Janet Yellen and a whole group of former heads of the former Council on Economic Advisors heads in the White House have stated clearly that the solvency problem is not a huge problem. It is overblown by those who want to destroy the system. It is not a big problem. You raise the cap, you're fine. It's a political football. And let's look at Social Security. I mean, how many people in this room get Social Security? Okay. Exactly. There are many people in this country who are living on Social Security only. There are many women who, because they haven't had equal pay, it's a big problem in this country, once they get to advanced age, they're not getting what they need out of Social Security. We have a terrible poverty problem among elderly Americans. We need to address this as a top priority. Not only are people going bankrupt, not only can they not live on their Social Security, but we now have an itinerant, we have people moving all over the country in caravans to get piece work, like the Okies in the Depression, and they are older Americans. This is shameful. We need to address Social Security by making sure people get increased benefits in Social Security. So yes, let's raise the caps. Let's think about older Americans, and let's not allow people to be impoverished and in need when they are 80 years old.
So a question not too far off, question from the audience is, what specific actions would you take to reduce the federal deficit?
Well, I will go back first to that issue of endless wars. Right now we are fighting unfunded wars. They're not even in the budget. They're supplementals. It's like taking your credit card and paying for war. So we're paying for war with debt. That hasn't happened since the Revolutionary War, where we were debtors to Britain and the Netherlands. But remember, after that war, Hamilton said flatly, we're going to have to repay this debt right now. We don't want to get into a situation where we have huge deficits because of our war. And they took care of it. So I think that we need to take a good hard look at the money that we are shoveling in the direction of these wars, and also because there's a shell game going on. We say, oh, well, we're reducing federal employees, or we're reducing, or we're not using that many troops. But in fact, we're using contractors, and the contractors are 2 times, 3 times, 4 times more expensive. We are paying more money than we need to. And so let's address all of that when we talk about getting rid of the deficit. Not to mention, let's not sign a tax bill that adds $1.9 trillion to the deficit. It's unbelievable that this has happened, because right now our deficit is heading for, in 2 years, it will be $1 trillion. That's where we're heading. And again, I will mention these. I'll mention Janet Yellen and what she said. She said tax cuts and endless wars, unfunded wars, are our biggest enemy here, not Social Security and Medicare, our deficit.
So sticking to the economy, and we've got about 10 minutes, so let's shorten the answers a little bit and let's try to localize it back to the 5th District. As you travel across the 5th District and you see with your own eyes the economy across the 5th District, what are the parts that are doing well and why? And what are the parts that are doing not so well and why? How have you assessed it from the ground?
First of all, in the 5th District, agriculture is number one. Mm-hmm. And number two is shared. It's timber, which is huge, south side. Mm-hmm. Timber. And which is sold to China, by the way. Timber, a lot of it, and tourism. So, for example, we see in the economy of Nelson County, hugely successful tourism. It's a wedding destination. It's breweries, distilleries. And I am endorsed, by the way, by the biggest distillery in the district. That's the Virginia Distillery Company, who have endorsed my campaign. Anyway, those hugely successful businesses. We have other areas that are less successful, for example, the areas where there is no more tobacco. What do we do about that area when we have all these successful breweries? Well, the candidate goes to Virginia Tech and asks questions, and Virginia Tech says, well, of course, it's malting barley is the answer. Malting barley is a cash crop. There is a tremendous need among distilleries and breweries for malting barley. They want local barley. We have it, and we can expand it. It's a huge area of expansion. I will definitely be pushing things like that. The other thing is, when you go to people who are very successful in the timber business in this district and say, well, what can we do with timber? They're selling pellets to Europe. They're selling wood to China. But what else can we do? Can we bring a factory in here which would not be just parachuted in, something that dovetails with what you are doing? And the answer, yes, there is an answer. There's a new technology for building low-rise buildings with wood rather than cement. This is a carbon sink. It's renewable. It's a great thing. It's being done. It's just starting in the United States. It's all over Europe. Apex, the company I mentioned earlier, doing renewables, is about to build their building in Charlottesville with this technology. It's wood that's cross-laminated. We could have a factory in the Fifth doing cross-laminated, and we can put it down in Charlotte County, for example. They want it, or we can put it in Halifax. We need to do things. First, my view on expanding business and the economy of the Fifth is there are great things going on here, so let's build on them. But let's look at agriculture for one second. Agriculture, for example, I mentioned the dairy farmer. The dairy farmer brings up, can I talk a little bit longer than 3 minutes?
Yeah, I got a couple other questions I want to get in, though. So.
Okay, but let me just mention that the dairy farmer, cows have to be milked 3 times a day. That's immigrant labor. Immigrants do that job. Poultry farmers, we've got poultry farms. Who's doing that labor? Immigrants are doing that job. When you go to all the ag people and say, what is your number one issue? The number one issue is immigration reform. We can all work together on that issue. It's very exciting to think of building that coalition that way. It's not just good people in Charlottesville. It's the whole agriculture world supports that. But anyway, so we have very successful agriculture businesses. They're getting slammed by tariffs. My dairy farmers, because now the Mexicans won't buy American cheese, there's a whole pool of milk sloshing around in the country, and the price of milk is going down. So they're getting hit. The soybean farmers down in Pennsylvania, they're getting hit too. In fact, that's good for me because some of them are Republican and they're voting for me.
Let me ask, in a short answer, looking back, the 5th District historically has been a manufacturing district. Would you agree, looking back, that NAFTA was not good for the 5th?
NAFTA did indeed hurt the 5th, but that's history.
Yep.
So what are we going to do now? And I really can't stress enough the excitement I feel and people here in Charlottesville in this business feel for renewables and what we can do in the 5th. You know, these are right now, in terms of growing numbers of jobs, the biggest job builder in the United States is solar power. And we are the ideal region in the whole East Coast region. The south side and southwest of Virginia are ideal for solar fields. So this is a great thing. My role, I see, is a connector between all the people in the 5th who have this idea. You know, great ideas all happen at the same time. Everyone has. So that is going to be extremely important. But also, when people like Corey Stewart go down to Danville and say, oh, well, you know, this is a terrible place, it's full of crime, and everyone's left, this is not true. Danville is experiencing, where I was last night for National Night Out, is experiencing a little renaissance. We need federal dollars to encourage this. There are already federal dollars there. We don't want to take them away. Because right now in Danville, the whole River District is being regenerated. People are staying in Danville now or coming back to Danville. This is a very good sign. It's not just people fleeing the city. There's a desire to, there's all kinds of projects going on. So I don't see it as, oh, sad Danville, no more textiles, no more tobacco. Every tobacco warehouse has been renovated. I mean, there are things, really good things happening there. We just need to encourage the local entrepreneurs.
Last economic question and almost the last question, so give me no more than a two-minute answer. The U.S. economy and Virginia's economy seems to be doing pretty well right now. The stock market, which is not necessarily a fair gauge, but it's, you know, an indicator, is up more than 5,000 points since January 20th of 2017. Unemployment is at its lowest point in years in Virginia and across the country. As we heard, second quarter of GDP was up more than 4%. Isn't it a fair to give some credit to the president?
Well, no, I'm not. I'm sorry. this has happened over time. I mean, you know, things have improved since 2009. I spent a lot of time covering the crash and why the crash happened and the aftermath of the crash. No, I wouldn't give credit to him for this.
If Hillary were president, would you?
No, because it's been a long time coming. But I would also say, in terms of the economy, I know that it will be used, and yes, it's wonderful. The stock market is effervescent. However, there are a lot of stock buybacks going on. There are a lot of things that are indicators that we should be a little concerned about what's happening right now. And when you say everything's going great, let's go join me down in Bedford with a lot of people who will sit around and tell you that it's not great for them. So we need to be mindful that that we have serious problems here. For example, one thing that affects, we have about 2,500 jobs available in Pennsylvania, Danville, and Halifax. It's a lot of jobs. A lot of them, everything from high skill down to McDonald's. Why aren't they filled? We talked about the training issues, but the other issue is people can't pass a drug test. We have an opioid plague in the district. We have a generation that is seriously in jeopardy because of this. So in terms of our needs, our good economy, yeah, it's great in Charlottesville. It is on fire in Charlottesville. But in other areas, we need to work hard to address the problems. You can't address employment issues without addressing treatment issues, not to mention mental health issues. These are all combined. When you talk to, one night I was at an event in Fluvanna, and there were a bunch of police at the back of the room, so I went and said, so what's your big issue? They said mental health by far. They said every night we're dealing with this. So let's think about the fifth.
Two remaining questions before you get to do your closing. Each question is 15 seconds. Literally, because we want to stay on time. One is, my question is, what's the last really fun book you read that you would recommend to us? Oh.
15 seconds. Say fun book?
Yeah.
I don't have time to read.
Yeah, right.
I read very serious books.
I can tell you've read a lot of policy documents. The other 15-second question, which is from the audience, is what amuses you? What makes you giggle? I was told that would be the last question. So.
15 seconds?
Yeah. What amuses you?
Oh, the surprises on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
It's endlessly entertaining, I can tell you, and fun. Aside from all of the difficulties, it's really fun.
Yeah. Well, first, before we go to your closing several-minute statement, let me thank the audience. We had some really great questions from the audience, and I only had to supplement a few of my own, so thank you all for this wonderful turnout and for your wonderful questions. And thank you to the senior statesman of Virginia for asking me and allowing me to come and have the fun job of moderating. I very much enjoyed it. So with that, your closing few minutes. Why should these folks vote for you?
Well, first of all, thank you for moderating it, and thank you for being someone with such a depth of experience. I appreciate it. And to my elusive opponent, I would say I hope you will turn up at the next debate. But to all of you, I would say we can accomplish a lot on Capitol Hill. One member of Congress said to me recently, don't let anyone tell you this is a dead-end job. We get a lot done up here. It is essential, from my point of view, flipping the 5th District and helping to flip the House of Representatives is a, for me, I cannot think of anything more important in my lifetime. I want to be able to say to my grandchildren, when they say to me, what were you doing in 2018? I want to be able to say, I fought and we won, and we changed America, and we put it back on course. This is a 7-day-a-week job. I have a wonderful family who put up with me doing this. Thank you to my husband, who has joined me on the trail. We can win. We can win the flip the fifth district. We can win, and I know we can, because I have been out there, and I have seen the excitement. As I say, I was in Danville last night. I was in Lunenburg, in Cumberland the night before, and there is tremendous excitement. We can do it, and we can, a nonpartisan thing we can do is we can open up the office of the 5th District in Washington. We can take the door off the hinges, and I've literally been asking how we can get that done, so that people feel welcome there, so that those kinds of questions that are asked, you come to that office, you regard it as your home and your embassy. No one will turn you away. No one's going to send you form letters answering the wrong question that you asked. And you need a representative who serves you. I've had a career, a star-studded, wonderful, many awards, that kind of career. Right now, it's time for public service. It is time for public service in the same way that Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt understood public service. I feel this very strongly. Work with me. We can do it. We can do a huge amount for the 5th District, and we can also make this a much better country. We can make America fair again. How about that? So thank you all, and thank you to the organizers of this event.
Thank you all.